All right, so this is Bio 160, and it is November 18th, Tuesday. And you have a test on Thursday. Let's take a look and see what's on the test on Thursday. It's chapters 12, 13, 14, and 16. We're going to skip 15 and come back to it. So 12 is blood. 13, cardiovascular system. 14 is immunity, and today we're going to cover respiratory system. So 12, 13, 14, and 16 on the test. All right, I've got quizzes to pass back to you after class. Your grades are hanging up over there, but if you can't find yourself on that list because it's not by your name or student number, I have it by your student name. So if you want to see me after class, I can go over your grades as well, and I can pass back your quizzes from last time. So are there any questions? Yeah, we get to play with some stuff today. The other thing that I want to mention before I forget, there's I sent you all an email. That's what I wanted to say. I sent you all an email with a link that has an electronic exercise to help you with a figure that is going to be on the test next time. And it has to do with pulmonary volume. So we'll go over that. I'll show you where that is. But it's really easy to get to. Okay, so let's start the respiratory system. I'm almost ready, but I need a pen. Here's a pen. All right, so the functions of the respiratory system include ventilation. That means moving air in and out of our lungs, so basically breathing. That's one important function. Another important function is gas exchange, the exchange between the air in our lungs and the blood. So we're going to be looking at compounds that move from the air into our blood. And then another important function is the transport of these respiratory gases in our blood. So we got to see how these gases like oxygen and CO2 are transported in our blood. And then not only are we interested in gas exchange between air in our lungs and the blood, but we're interested in the other end too, in capillaries that are in our systemic circulation. So gas exchange between blood and the tissues, because eventually we want oxygen that's in the air to get into our mitochondria, so mitochondria in our cells can make ATP. All right, so first oxygen has to move into our lungs, and then from the lungs into blood. And then when in the tissues, oxygen moves from the blood into the actual tissues themselves. And that occurs by diffusion only. So how do molecules move by diffusion? Due to a concentration gradient, right? A concentration gradient. And which way does a molecule move according to its concentration gradient? From low to high or from high to low? Always from high to low, right? So the reason why oxygen gets to our tissues is because oxygen is high concentration in the air and low concentration in our tissue. So oxygen flows down that concentration gradient. All right, well, let's look at some anatomy. We can break the respiratory system down into two main parts. There's the upper respiratory tract and the lower respiratory tract. The upper respiratory tract is composed of the nose and nasal cavity and the pharynx. So here's a pretty good picture. All right, that's shows the oral cavity and the nasal cavity and the nose and a nostril right here. And another name for the pharynx, or the common name for the pharynx, is your throat. All right, so the back of your mouth or your throat is a common passageway for air that we breathe as well as things that we drink and eat. All right, but things that we eat, we want them to go into the esophagus, into our stomach, but air that we breathe, we want to go into an airway, namely the trachea right here. All right, well, so we'll see how that's controlled in just a little bit. So the hard palate is the roof of the mouth. You have a soft palate toward the posterior part of the mouth that actually moves up and covers the passageway into the nasal cavity, for instance, when we swallow something because we don't want food going up into our nasal cavity. So the soft palate moves around a little bit. Okay, so pharynx, when you get a sore throat, what's the name for a sore throat? The scientific name, the clinical name for a sore throat. And we've all had sore throats. That's really, it's called tonsillitis. Oh, that's close, tonsillitis. But just a, it doesn't, but maybe if it doesn't affect the tonsils per se, you can still get a sore throat. All right, maybe it doesn't affect the tonsils, but you're right, a tonsillitis would be a sore throat. But since another name for the throat is the pharynx, we could call it a pharyngitis. Pharyngitis, that's a sore throat, okay? Okay, so that's what makes up the upper respiratory tract. And then the lower respiratory tract starts with the larynx. And then it also includes the trachea and bronchus and the lungs. So when we go back to this slide right here, right here is the upper respiratory tract. Air will come down to here. This is the beginning of the larynx. And so that has cartilage in it. That's kind of, you can feel it in your neck, right? And it produces that thing that we call an Adam's apple right here. That's the larynx. That's the beginning of the lower respiratory tract, and it continues down through the larynx into the trachea, right, into the bronchial tree, and then finally into the lungs. So this is the line of demarcation for the lower respiratory tract. So let's look at some of these structures in a little bit more detail. So this is a nice exam figure right here. We want to look at the larynx, including the epiglottis, some vocal cords, the voice box, and all these things on this sheet right here. All right, so here is a really nice picture that shows, again, shows the nasal cavity, and you can see the shelves in the nasal cavity. We call these the nasal conchae, and these help air condition the air that we breathe into our bodies. For instance, if the air is cold, the nasal conchae warm it up, or if the air is hot, the nasal conchae cool it down so that we don't burn our lungs. If the air is dry, the nasal concha has a mucous membrane, so it humidifies the air so we don't turn our lungs into potato chips. So it does a lot of conditioning of the air. And if there's dust particles like there are outside today, the nasal concha right here helps trap those dust particles so that we don't inhale the dust particles into our lungs. All right, so nasal cavity. The back of the mouth is called the pharynx. Okay, and here is the beginning of the larynx right here. Furthermore, the pharynx can be broken down into three parts. Right in the back of the mouth, we call that the oropharynx. Oro just means mouth. Superior to that, what is the cavity that's superior to the oral cavity? That's the nasal cavity. So the part of the pharynx that's more closely associated with the nasal cavity is called the nasopharynx. So here's a nasopharynx right here, all right? And then the part of the throat that's associated with the larynx right over here, we call that the laryngopharynx. So the pharynx actually has these three parts to it: nasopharynx, oropharynx, and laryngopharynx. And that's just all part of your throat. And also now we can see where the tonsils are. Here are the palatine tonsils. They're not right on midline, but they're bilateral. Those are the ones that can become chronically infected and are most commonly removed, are the palatines right here. There's a lingual tonsil right up over here. And again, the job of these tonsils is to protect your body from infection that is trying to, like bacteria that you're breathing in or eating or something. And that happens all the time, right? So these are important immune structures. All right, the lower respiratory tract starts right here. And it has a lot of cartilage. This part is what we call the larynx. And sometimes you get an infection of the larynx. And what do you call that? Okay, so if an infection of the pharynx is a pharyngitis, an infection of the larynx is a laryngitis. And you're pretty familiar with that, because what happens to you when you have laryngitis? Thank goodness you can still breathe, but you can't speak very well. Your voice is really raspy and low, and maybe makes only little squeaks and things like that. Okay, because in the larynx right here, you have vocal cords. There are some ligaments that have tension on them, and as air rushes past these ligaments, they vibrate back and forth, and they make a noise that you can hear. All right, so the vocal cords are in the larynx, and we get laryngitis. Those don't work quite so well. So it's easy to remember the larynx from the pharynx if you think of that. All right, one important point or part of the larynx right here is a special trapdoor, right? Because when you swallow something, you don't want food or stuff that you're drinking to end up in the larynx, because what happens when it's in the larynx? If you get a solid object in the larynx, it's going to fall right down into the trachea, and it might block this airway, or it might fall down into this bronchus and bronca and block a bronchus, or deeper into your lung and block air into a lung. But of course, is breathing a good thing or a bad thing? It's a really good thing, right? So you don't want to disrupt that breathing that you're doing by getting some kind of foreign object in here. And this is sort of like shooting pool. All you have to do is get a solid object over the trachea, and it's going to fall right in. Right? Gravity is just going to let that object fall right in because the trachea is held open all the time. It's a tube that's open. So there is an important mechanism that blocks off the opening to the larynx, which is what we call the glottis, and that is this epiglottis right here. That's the trapdoor. So when you swallow something, this trapdoor goes from this position like this to like that. And then food slides off the anterior part of it into the esophagus right here and into your stomach. So that's normally what happens. But the first part of swallowing something is a voluntary mechanism. It's not automatic. It's a voluntary mechanism, so you have conscious control of it. Like, you don't ever just start swallowing when you're walking down the sidewalk, right, automatically. Right? You swallow when your brain tells your throat and mouth to swallow something. Your mouth and throat don't make up its own mind when to swallow. And because it's under your voluntary control, it can get confused sometimes. Maybe this trapdoor isn't going to work when you swallow something, and then what happens? It can go into the larynx and the trachea and can cause you to choke. And by the way, when somebody is choking, who knows how to solve that situation? Anybody have a chokehold? No, don't do a chokehold. That's not what you said, but anyway. There is a procedure called what? A Heimlich maneuver. Who's familiar with a Heimlich maneuver? You're CPR certified, right? You compressurize the chest, and that forces air up from the lungs into the trachea, and it expels that object, right? It's just going to come shooting right out of somebody's mouth, so point them in the good direction. And that clears the airway. Okay, so there's a time when this epiglottis doesn't work because it's under voluntary control. And there's a day of the week where this epiglottis gets lazy. Okay? You're laughing. That's a good, you might know what the day of the week that is. So some of you that are CPR certified probably know that under these circumstances, you should be a little diligent, right? And just pay attention to people around you. Make sure they don't choke on this particular day. Okay? And there's also a time during that day where most people choke. So there's a day of the week and there's a time when most people choke. So who knows? What is the day that most people choke? Anybody? No? Nobody's heard what day of the week most people choke? Sunday? That's not a bad guess. A weekend day? That's not a bad guess. That'd be maybe my third choice. Really close third choice, though. Friday. Friday's it. Yes, Friday is it. Now, what time on Friday do most people choke? Like where? I couldn't quite hear. Oh, end of the working hours. This is true. Specifically during happy hour. Okay, Friday afternoon happy hour, a bunch of people. Now, you're starting to laugh. Now, don't swallow anything when you're laughing. A bunch of people go out to a restaurant someplace and maybe share a pitcher of beer. So there's usually adult beverage associated with this. And you're eating what? You're eating like nachos or popcorn shrimp or something. And so you eat some popcorn shrimp just as you're ready to swallow. Somebody says, oh, my anatomy teacher does such and such and such. And then everybody breaks into a laugh just as you start to swallow, right? So that's when that popcorn shrimp can get into this trachea right here. So Friday nights, Saturday nights, when people are kind of horsing around having a good time, that's the prime time for people to go into a choking fit. All right, and of course that could be very lethal unless somebody knows how to clear their airway. Now, if you start choking, what should you do? What's the universal sign for choking? Okay, two hands up by your throat like this. All right, so somebody that knows. Because when you're choking, you can't say anything. So you just go like this, and then somebody knows to do that Heimlich maneuver for you. All right. But if you're educated in that Heimlich maneuver and you see somebody choking, should you just run up to them and do the Heimlich maneuver on them? You're shaking your head no. What do you do first? Yeah, you should ask them, are you choking? Right? And if they can't answer you, that means what? They're probably choking. And so you have some standing in court in case you get sued, right? When you do the Heimlich maneuver on somebody, that they won't turn around and sue you. Okay, so he said, well, I had evidence. He didn't say. But maybe he just didn't speak your language. You never know. Okay? It's just kind of a gamble. So that's the job of what? The epiglottis right here. It prevents food from entering the trachea. Yeah. Maybe, but maybe, I don't know if that will work in every circumstance, because there's something blocking that airway, all right? So that might dislodge something, okay? But the best thing to do is to get that blockage out of there. Heimlich maneuver is by far the best. But if you're all by yourself, if you're all by yourself, there's nobody around, try to do something, okay? Maybe try to expand your chest or whatever, relax. Okay, relax, because anytime you tighten up, that makes the constriction even greater. Okay, so what is that? That's the beginning of the lower respiratory tract. Okay, the trachea is the airway between the larynx and the lungs, right here. So there's your trachea. And the trachea is held open all the time. So here is a view of some of the cartilages that make up the larynx. I don't think you have to know these things, all right? But here's the thyroid cartilage. That's that prominent piece of cartilage that you can see under somebody's chin. And below that is the trachea right here. And it's held open by these cartilaginous rings. They're shaped like a C. And so the trachea is open all the time, so that's why it's susceptible for stuff falling inside of it. But that's important, because when you exhale, for instance, especially when you're exercising, when you want to move a lot of air out of your lungs, how do you exhale maximally? What do you have to do to your chest to get the most amount of air out of your lungs, like when you're exercising? What do you have to do? You have to contract a lot of muscles, right? So you got to pressurize your chest. You have to constrict your chest. And when you pressurize and constrict your chest, the trachea right here would do what? It would constrict as well, and when you pressurize your chest, and if it constricted, then air wouldn't be able to leave your lungs. So it's got to be held open all the time by this cartilage in order for you to breathe properly. Okay. So the other thing about the trachea is that it has a special lining. It has a special epithelium. Remember, an epithelium is a kind of tissue that covers a surface in your body or lines a cavity, but in this particular case, it's going to cover a surface, the inside of your trachea, and it is, so here's a basement membrane, here's the apical surface, and as you look at the apical surface right here, what do you see up there? Yeah, cilia. What's the function of cilia again? It's for motility, right? They're always sweeping, they're beating. And there are goblet cells that secrete mucus into the cilia. These trap dust particles in the mucus. So here comes a dust particle. It gets trapped, and then the cilia sweep and clear the trachea and help clear your lungs from filling up with dust. So which way do you think the cilia are sweeping? Are they sweeping up or down? Yeah. I must have told you that already. Everybody knew that. Okay, so they sweep up. And it sweeps all that garbage into your pharynx or your mouth. And then what do? You swallow it. And just swallow it down, get it out of your mouth. Unless you're a baseball player, then what do? Then you spit it out all the time. Right. Okay. All right, so don't forget about that mucous membrane lining the trachea. All right, then the trachea bifurcates into two bronchi. You have a right and left main bronchus that go to either the right or left lung. So here's a main bronchus here, and here's a main bronchus over here. It has the same function and look to it as the trachea. And then the lung has different lobes. So the bronchi bifurcate again. They split. And the lobes even have smaller lobules attached to them. And so the bronchioles, the secondary bronchi split again into tertiary bronchi. And they keep splitting. But in each one of these cases, right, it is held open by cartilage. So there's cartilage in the larynx, there's cartilage in the trachea, and there's cartilage in all these different bronchi. Okay. So the lungs have different lobes, right? Well, first there's a right and a left. And you can see the right has three lobes and the left has two. It has less lobes. Oh, look at that. Why do you think it has less lobes? Because you have the heart on the left side of your chest as well. So that takes up some space. All right, so there's less lobes and less lobules. All right, and then the tertiary bronchi will bifurcate into smaller and smaller passageways that are going to feed air to these small spaces that we call alveoli. This is the functional space in your lungs where gas exchange takes place. That's an alveolus. Alveolus is one, is singular. Alveoli is plural. All right, so these bronchioles that feed air to the alveoli don't contain cartilage. They only contain smooth muscle. So the bronchi have cartilage, but bronchioles don't have cartilage. They have smooth muscle, and that smooth muscle can contract and can block off a bronchiole. For instance, when somebody has asthma, and then if these bronchioles are constricted, they need to take a bronchodilator so that they can start breathing normally again. Okay, so they get air inside the alveolus. So let's see what that alveolus looks like. Here's the larynx, here's the trachea, primary bronchus, secondary bronchus, and notice all of these bronchi have cartilage on them, holding them open, so they don't collapse when you're trying to exhale. And when you get to the end of a bronchus, what do we got right here? When you get to an end of a bronchus, way down over here, you have a bronchiole. And the bronchiole does not have cartilage, and then it feeds a little respiratory bronchiole, and then an alveolar duct, and then that alveolar duct feeds air to this group of things that kind of looks like a bunch of grapes. And each one of these grapes is called an alveolus. That's the site for gas exchange between air that's in your lungs and the blood. So let's look at that alveolus, or alveolus. Either way you want to talk about it. Okay, so here you can see a bronchiole. It's got smooth muscle, no cartilage. And here's a terminal bronchiole. On some terminal bronchioles, they even have some alveoli themselves. But most alveoli are packaged in this bundle, right? And then an alveolar duct. So it's just a little ball or berry. And surrounding every alveolus is a capillary network. And remember, a capillary is the vascular structure where exchange can take place. There's something else around every alveolus, which is not on your diagram here, but I drew it in with these blue lines. There are elastic proteins. What can you tell me about elastic, something that's elastic? Yeah, you can stretch it, and then when you release that tension, what happens to it? It snaps back to its original location. Right. So that has some important implications for how we move air in and out of our lungs. There's a lot of elasticity in alveoli. Okay, so let me just talk about the mechanics of breathing just a little bit, just for a second. Here's a nice slide on the mechanics of breathing. So here you can see the nice trachea and the lungs. This is somebody at rest. There's no air in their lungs. Here is the diaphragm, and the diaphragm, when it's at rest, has a nice dome shape to it. All right? And when we want to inhale, we have to contract the diaphragm, and what happens to the diaphragm then? It flattens out. And when it flattens out, this area, or this volume, see this volume right here, between the dotted line and the curved diaphragm, the thoracic cavity increases by that size. And when that happens, that decreases the pressure in the lungs, and air goes from high pressure in the atmosphere to low pressure in the lungs, and the lungs inflate. Okay, so that's mostly due to contraction of the diaphragm, this muscle. There are some intercostal muscles between the ribs that raise the rib cage out, that increases the volume of the thoracic cavity, decreasing the pressure so that air flows in. Okay, but now how do we exhale? We don't need, under normal quiet breathing that you're breathing at right now, we don't need muscles to get air out of our lungs, because There is elasticity in all of these muscles so that when the muscles relax, they go back to their original shape, like this. But also, after an alveolus is expanded, what does it do when you relax? It gets smaller because of these elastic proteins right here. And the alveolus shrinks, and that forces air out of your lungs as well. Okay? So we could do a little test right now. Let's do a little test. I've got a couple paper bags and a balloon, and the test that I want you to do to tell me which one is a better model of an alveolus, a paper bag or this balloon. Okay? So you probably know this already. All right, so here is an alveolus. Let's inflate it. All right, so I trapped a bunch of air inside this alveolus, and now I'll relax, and what's going to happen to the air inside this alveolus, this paper bag? Is it going to flow out? Okay, let me just leave it right here. Is it going to flow out? Oh, it just stayed there. Well, that would be terrible if that's my lungs, because if there's air in the lungs already, you can't inhale anymore. Right? So that would be really bad. So a paper bag is not a really good model for how an alveolus works. Because why? There is no elastic tissue in this paper bag. Once it's inflated, it just stays inflated. That's not how a healthy lung works. That's maybe how a diseased lung might work. All right, so here is a balloon. Which is representing an alveolus right here. Okay, so it's inflated. Oops, sorry. So here's an alveolus that's inflated. Now, if I relax, what's going to happen to the air inside this alveolus? Is it going to stay stuck inside the balloon, like this paper bag? No, it's going to come out because why? It's elastic, just like the alveoli in your lungs. So when you relax, air is just going to, air is just going to be expelled from your lungs because of the elastic properties of that alveolus. So don't forget about those elastic things in there. That's really important. Okay, so that's kind of it about the elastic properties and the anatomy of the lung. Okay, now let's not forget about the pleural cavities. The lungs are in the thoracic cavity. And do you remember the difference between a serous membrane and a serous membrane? No, a mucous membrane and a serous membrane. A mucous versus serous. A mucous membrane is like what lines the trachea, because the trachea is what? Open to the outside world. That's a mucous membrane. What about a serous membrane? It lines a cavity that is not open to the outside world, like the cavities that your lungs are in. What do you call the cavities your lungs are in? You could say, yeah, somebody said pleural. That's what I like to hear. The pleural cavities, and the pleural cavities are in the thoracic cavity, right? But the pleural cavities. So here we have a transverse section of the pleural, of actually across the chest, so we can see the heart right here. That's in the pericardial cavity, and the mediastinum, that's a cavity that the heart is into. And these are all in the thoracic cavity. But here is the pleural cavity that the lungs are in. So remember, a serous membrane has got three divisions to it. It's got one part that lines, that's right on the surface of the wall of the body. Then there's a space, and then there's another membrane that lines the organ that's inside the cavity. And see, these all have different names. The membrane that is touching the lungs, right on the surface of the lungs, we call that the visceral serous membrane. But since that's the pleural membrane, we would call that the visceral pleura, visceral pleural membrane. And then here is the pleural space filled with fluid, serous fluid. And then the membrane that's lining the thoracic cavity or touching the wall of the thorax, that's what we call the parietal pleura. Right? So those are the three divisions of that serous membrane. And there is like a watery fluid in this pleural space right here that helps attach the wall of the thorax to the surface of the lung so that when the thorax expands, it pulls on the lungs and it helps inflate the lungs. All right, so I want to show you a little model on how inspiration takes place. So I got another balloon right here. And the glass part of this demonstration just represents your thoracic cage, right, your chest wall. And the two little balloons in there represent your lungs, right? And that hole in the stopper, that's your trachea. That's an airway for getting air in and out of the lungs, right? And this dark rubber right here, this black rubber thing, represents a muscle. What muscle is that? That's the diaphragm, okay? And so I'm going to inflate and deflate these balloons just by changing the volume of this container right here. And I can change the volume by working the diaphragm, okay? So when the diaphragm is relaxed, how is it? Is it flat or is it dome-shaped? It's dome-shaped. So I'm going to push up on the, I can't block the hole because then it won't work, right? So if I push up on the diaphragm, what about the balloons? Who can tell me something about the balloons? Are they inflated or deflated? They're deflated. See, they're deflated. Now, how about if I contract the diaphragm by doing what? Pulling it down, increasing the volume of this chamber. And when we increase the volume, that decreases the pressure. Look at what happens to the balloons. Is that good like that?
Yeah.
Okay. Did they inflate? I'm blinded by the light. Okay. Okay, they inflated. And then when you relax, don't forget the lungs are elastic, just like these balloons. The diaphragm is elastic. It goes like that. And so air just flows in and out of your lungs as a result of pressure changes. All right, so here's a pretty good model. So don't forget that diaphragm. It's important for inspiration. Okay. And the serous membranes in here, that's probably pretty important. So we got the parietal pleura. Where do you find the parietal pleura again? That's the surface of the thoracic cavity. The visceral pleura lines the surface of the lungs. And then the pleural cavity is filled with pleural fluid. So that acts to couple the thoracic cavity to the lungs. Now, did we ever do this experiment? I'm not too sure. Is water a slippery substance or a sticky substance? It's sticky. It is sticky. Okay. And so, for instance, if I have these two acetates right here, did we do this experiment in class already? No. Good. So here I have a couple acetates, a couple transparencies, and they're dry. And if I stick them together and I hold on to one of them, what's going to happen to the one I'm not holding on to? It's not going to stick, right? It's just going to fall off, right? Because they're dry. There's nothing holding them together. But now if I put some water on them, what's going to happen? Oh, look at all this junk in here. It's going to get wet. We might all get wet. I'm not sure. Okay, so it's just water, no glue. So I put the transparencies together like that. So now I'm holding both of them, and I'll let go of one, and look, they're stuck together. And that's because water's sticky. Water molecules like to stick together. And maybe you've been outside walking along a lake or a stream or something, and you can even see animals walking right on water. What kind of animals can do that? Like water spiders and insects and things like that, because there's surface tension. The water molecules like to stick together, and those animals aren't heavy enough to push the water molecules aside. All right, so as a matter of fact, how much surface tension is on these two pieces of paper? Try to pull on this one right here, and let's see. Let me pull. A lot? A lot of tension. Are you kind of surprised? Quite a bit, right? I couldn't lift you out of the chair, probably. But still, there's a lot of surface tension on these two sheets. It's amazing. Oh, even that, just that little bit right there. Okay. So that surface tension attaches, right, that surface tension attaches the wall of the thorax to the lung so that when the thorax expands, it actually pulls on the lungs and helps the lung expand too. But there's a place in the lung where that would be very detrimental if that were to happen. And that is in this little alveolus right here. When there's no air in the alveolus, the walls of the alveolus could touch each other, and if it was just water, what would happen? They would stick together, and there would be no way that you could inflate your lungs. And then that would be the end of the story for you, right? You'd suffocate. So your lungs have to produce a compound. Your lungs produces a compound which defeats that property of water. That property of water is what we call surface tension. Okay, where is it? I've got it someplace really close. On the floor. Page 2. Okay. Well, I'm going to use this slide right here. Okay. So that substance that decreases surface tension specifically in an alveolus so that an alveolus can expand is called surfactant. It means surface active agent. And you have this one? You guys are shuffling around. You don't have this one? Oh. Well, I'll talk about it anyway. Okay. It has surfactant, which allows the lungs to inflate. It defeats surface tension. And this is the compound that premature babies cannot make. All right, so when somebody's born prematurely, they have really poor pulmonary function or lung function because the lungs aren't making surfactant and they can't inflate their lungs. So what do we do to a newly born person whose lungs aren't developed? Where do we put them because they have trouble breathing? In an incubator that has a high oxygen content, right? So even though they're not inflating their lungs maximally like us grown-ups can, they can still absorb enough oxygen so that they can stay alive until their lungs develop and produce surfactant, and then they can inflate their lungs. Okay, so that's the job of surfactant. Okay, so the respiratory membrane is just the area or the space that oxygen and carbon dioxide have to diffuse across to get into the blood. So where is that respiratory membrane at? So what we're looking at here is an alveolus. So here is that circular structure, so air can move in and out. And the kind of cell that makes up an alveolus is just a simple squamous kind of cell. So what's a simple squamous epithelium? Just one layer thick, and it's what? Really flat cells. So this is a squamous cell. So oxygen that's in the alveolus right here is going to diffuse into a capillary. So what does it have to move across? It has to move across the wall of the alveolus, which is just one cell. It's got to move across this interstitial space right here, and then it's got to move into the capillary. And what kind of cell does this capillary look like it's made out of? Is it really thick or is it thin? Another thin cell. That's a squamous cell as well. So that's the respiratory membrane. And then one other thing that I'd like for you to know, right on the surface of the wall of the alveolus is this layer of that compound that defeats surface tension. What is this compound right here? That's surfactant. Right. So the respiratory membrane is made out of that little layer of surfactant, the wall of the alveolus, a little interstitial space that's very narrow, and the wall of the capillary. All right, so oxygen goes in that direction. What about CO2, carbon dioxide? What direction is it moving in? It's going to move out of your body from the capillary into the alveolus right here. Okay, so on this diagram, you can see the wall, the cells that make up the wall of the alveolus. Here is a surfactant-secreting cell, and then here is a macrophage. This is a monocyte that's crawled out of your circulatory system and is just patrolling all these different alveoli gobbling up bacteria and dust particles and things like that. So that's an immune cell. Okay, so this is sort of an interesting little slide. Your lung contains about 300 million of those little berries for gas exchange or alveoli. That's a pretty big number. And if you have an apple and you peel the peel off of an apple and make it flat on a table, you could measure the surface area of that apple, right? So surface area is what? It's just a two-dimensional. It's an X and Y. Like the surface area of, what's the surface area of this piece of paper right here? We could roll it up and curl it up to make it fit on an apple, but it's what? It's 8.5 inches by 11, and to calculate it, you just multiply those two numbers together to give you the surface area. And what is the best way to think of surface area in everyday language? What is a surface area, especially in the lungs, what can it be thought of? I guess I haven't talked to you about that. All right, so let's look at this doorway right here. What's the surface area of this doorway? Well, let's measure it because I got a ruler. How wide is it? This is a meter stick. It's what? 1 meter wide? Okay. By how tall? Here's 1 meter. Here's 2 meters. It's exactly 2 meters. So what's the surface area? It's 1 times 2. So it's what? 2 square meters. All right, so this doorway is 2 square meters. Now, let's think of the garage door that you might have at your house that a car drives through. What's the surface area of a garage door compared to this one right here? Well, it's huge. It might be, what? Might be 10 times the size? Something like that? Okay, so instead of 2, maybe it's 20 square meters. So how many people can get through this doorway at one time? 2, 3, something like that? Okay. 4, maybe if they're well behaved, I don't know, but 2 is probably pretty good. How many people can get through your garage door at one time? Oh, a lot, maybe 20, 30 people. So as the surface area increases, how does exchange go? Through the doorway. As the surface area increases, what happens to exchange? It increases as well, right? In kind of a big way, right? So when you think of surface area, what I want you to think of is what? It's really a doorway for exchange. So when you say surface area, think of doorway. The more surface area, the more exchange can take place. So in the lungs, what's the size of that doorway? Well, you got about 300 million alveoli. That makes a surface area of 70 square meters. That's huge. What is that in real life terms? Some of us might be able to relate to this. That's half of a tennis court. All right, so you all kind of know how big a tennis court is. That's about 70 square meters. That's the doorway for exchange for oxygen entering our body and CO2 leaving our body. And the reason why it fits in our body is because why? It's all folded up. The tennis court is all folded up into the shape of these alveoli. So the shape of the alveolus is specialized for exchange of respiratory gases. That's the important concept right here. And I'm really partial to that design because I can't imagine why I would like to be as wide as a tennis court and as tall as half a tennis court. So that's a good thing all those things are folded up in there. All right, so that's the alveolus. And, you know, we like to actually measure in people how much air, how good their pulmonary function is. And we can use a special instrument that we call a spirometer that measures the amount of air that we can breathe in and out of our bodies at any particular time. So since we're using that spirometer, this part of measuring these volumes is called spirometry. And so that's an important, so a pulmonologist would be very interested in these volumes, these pulmonary volumes. So it can be used to diagnose the health of the lungs and maybe how to treat somebody if we know what some of these volumes are. So in your book, you have a nice diagram of these different volumes. So I'm going to go over these volumes with you. Here it is right here. So this is a plot of lung volume versus time. And what are you doing right now when you're just kind of sitting still? You are? You're breathing in, and you're breathing out, and then what do you do again? You breathe in, and then you breathe out, right? So think of that as like the ocean tides coming in and going out again, right? So that volume that you're breathing right now, since you're not exercising, is what we call tidal volume. And you can see that it's about 500 mLs, about a half a liter that you breathe in and out of your bodies when you're not exercising, okay? But what can you do? When after you exhale a normal tidal volume, you still have a lot of air left in your lungs, right? So kind of just exhale normally. Can you exhale even more air out of your lungs if you tried really hard? You could go, compress your chest, compress your abdominal muscles, right? That forces the diaphragm up into the lungs, that expels a lot of air. So you can even move a lot more air out of your lungs. We call this the expiratory reserve volume. So you see it marked right over here. So from the end, from the bottom of a tidal volume to the most amount of air that you can breathe out, we call this the expiratory reserve volume. And you use that when you start exercising or hyperventilating, when you need a lot more oxygen in your body. All right, there's a corresponding volume in your lungs from the top of a normal inspiration. So just take a normal inspiration. And what can you do when you get to that top of normal inspiration? Can you take any more air into your lungs? All right, well, you got to try it. People are shaking their head no, but we got to try it. Okay, so a normal inspiration is like that. And then what can you do? You can go. You can take a lot more air into your lungs. You can really maximally inflate your lungs. All right, and so this is it right here. This is called the inspiratory reserve volume. So under normal breathing, you use the tidal volume, but when you start to exercise, you're going to use the expiratory reserve as well as the inspiratory reserve volume. Up to a maximal inspiration, so the peak of this inspiratory reserve volume, that's a maximal inspiration, and the bottom of this expiratory reserve volume right here, that's what we call a maximal expiration. All right, so you got to be familiar with these different things. So this is an exam figure. So there's another volume that's inside your lungs. All right, so after you exhale as much air out of your lungs as you possibly can, you still have air left in there because your trachea doesn't collapse, the bronchioles don't collapse, and even the alveoli don't collapse completely flat. So there's always some air in your lungs that you can't expel no matter what you do, right? Unless you get crushed by a bus or something, squishes your chest, right? And that's what we call the residual volume. So residual volume is the amount of air that you can never get out of your lungs no matter how hard you try. That is always there. And as people get lung disease, guess what happens to this residual volume? It gets bigger and bigger and bigger, right? But your chest really doesn't get any bigger. So when your residual volume, when you have lung disease, guess what happens to your tidal volume and your inspiratory reserve volume and your expiratory reserve volume? It goes away. It decreases. And then as your lung disease gets worse and worse and worse and worse and worse, guess what happens? Well, you can't hardly breathe any air in and out of your lungs anymore. And that's when you need what? Lung transplant or oxygen. Yeah, oxygen. Okay, so it's good to protect your lungs, right? So that you maintain a good volume for breathing. So a lot of times we combine these different volumes that we voluntarily can move in and out of our lungs, namely what? The expiratory reserve volume, the tidal volume, and combine it with the inspiratory reserve volume and call that a capacity. That's the amount of air that we can move in and out of our bodies, and we call that the vital capacity. So capacity is composed of three volumes. What are those three volumes? Tidal volume, expiratory reserve, and inspiratory reserve volume, right? And hopefully those are large in you. Okay, so vital capacity is what? Number one, number two, and number three put together. Residual capacity, that's something you can never adjust by breathing. You're just stuck with whatever is there. And hopefully it never gets really big and takes over your lungs. All right, so that's an exam figure. So I have a little, did that beep up there? Oh, good. All right, so I have a little electronic exercise. This is, of course, in your notes. You can practice labeling this, but we have a little electronic exercise for you to do online that I sent you that email on. So I turned the projector off. I hope I'll be able to turn it back on. And where is it? It's right there. All right, so you log into Blackboard, and here's your course, right? 10-5-28, Bio 160. And you can go look at announcements, but you actually have your announcements right here. So here's that last email that I sent everybody. All right, well, let's just go and look at this. Let's see if I'm hooked up to the internet. So here's your course. All right, here's that announcement. And I emailed everybody this link, so you can copy this link down, but if you have email, don't bother, because all you have to do is click on it, and it's going to take you to this figure right here that I designed for you. So what is this? These show the pulmonary volumes, right? And this over here just represents the different spaces. So from here to here represents these little waves. What volume is this right here? That's a tidal volume. So if I click on that, what should it say? Tidal volume. Ah, very good. You don't have to know the numbers, okay? But you should at least know that's tidal volume. All right, what do we call this big wave right here, which corresponds to this volume? What's that volume called? Inspiratory reserve volume. Is that right? Oh, good. Okay. And then what about this volume down over here that you can never change? You can never get this amount of air out of your lungs. What do you call that? That's the residual volume. So far, so good. Okay, and then after, at the bottom of a normal tidal volume, you can even exhale more air, right here. What's that called? The space. That's the expiratory reserve volume. Super. Okay, so at the top of a maximal inspiration, well, what do we call that? That's just a maximal inspiration. This down over here is a maximal expiration. Okay, and then the last thing that you got to know, what do we call that thing, right? It's kind of a contrived volume. If we add expiratory reserve volume, tidal volume, and inspiratory reserve volume together, which corresponds to this rectangle right here, what do we call that? That's vital capacity, right? That's just the amount of air that we can breathe in and out of our lungs when we try really hard. So that's vital capacity. All right, so you can practice labeling this diagram, and then when you see it on the test, it should be, what, just really easy to do. Okay, so those are the things you should know. You don't have to know everything that's on the figure, right? Just these things right here, the volumes, residual volume, the three other volumes, vital capacity, maximum inspiration, and maximum expiration. You don't even have to know these numbers. But our lung volume is about 6 liters. And tidal volume is about 500 mLs. Okay. So I wanted to show you that. And we'll turn that projector off. And if I can turn this back on, fantastic. Okay. So that's that. So how do we transport these vital gases in the blood? Let's talk about oxygen transport. That's what mitochondria need. 97% of the oxygen that's transported in the blood is bound to hemoglobin, which is a compound in red blood cells. Probably you had to know that for this test coming up, right, in red blood cells. It combines with the heme part. What's that little funny element that's in heme that makes oxygen bind to it? Iron, right? It needs an iron group in there. So blood needs iron. And it's reversible. It comes off when it goes into the tissues. 3% of oxygen can dissolve in plasma. So there's not very much oxygen that can dissolve in plasma. Most of it has to bind to hemoglobin, which is inside red blood cells. All right, but carbon dioxide is also transported out of your body. 8% can dissolve in plasma. That's a lot more than 3% compared to oxygen, but that's still not a lot. Right? 20% can combine with blood proteins. The proteins that are in your blood will transport carbon dioxide around, but most of it is converted into something else. It's converted into another chemical compound, and that chemical compound is called bicarbonate. So let's look at this equation. So your cells are producing CO2. That's a waste gas, and CO2 can combine with what's H2O? Water, right? And it's going to form hydrogen ion. What's hydrogen ion the basis for? What's a measure of the hydrogen ion concentration called? pH. That's an acid, right? So CO2 produces this acid right here, and then bicarbonate. So that's HCO3, and it's got a minus sign because that H plus actually belongs to it, but it breaks apart to produce that hydrogen ion. And bicarbonate is very soluble in water. It's as soluble as sugar even. So when you put sugar in your tea or coffee in the morning, what happens to it? It just dissolves right in there. The same thing for bicarbonate. But look at this reaction. How many arrows do you see? There's two arrows. So carbon dioxide can become bicarbonate, but you also have an arrow going the other way. It can be converted back into carbon dioxide. So there's an enzyme that causes this interconversion between carbon dioxide and bicarbonate, and you got to know the name of that enzyme. I don't know if anybody knows the name of that enzyme, but it is called carbonic anhydrase. There's a C. Anhydrase. Carbonic anhydrase. And so you have a lot of carbonic anhydrase in your red blood cells and your blood, so that when your tissues that are producing CO2, this carbonic anhydrase converts it into bicarbonate. Bicarbonate gets transported to your lungs, and in your lungs, carbonic anhydrase converts it back to CO2, and it goes from your blood into the alveolus, and you breathe it out of your body. So that's how that system works. So you got to have that enzyme in order for it to function properly. Okay, so carbonic anhydrase. So how is most of the oxygen transported in your blood? How would you say that? Your oxygen is transported in blood how? Just dissolved in the plasma? Bound to proteins? Bound to what? Hemoglobin in red blood cells. Yes, bound to hemoglobin. Well, now what about carbon dioxide? How is carbon dioxide transported in your body? Most of it anyway, 72%, is transported as a different compound altogether, as bicarbonate, right? So then you might say, well, how does carbon dioxide get converted into bicarbonate? You could say, oh, that's because there's an enzyme. What's the name of that enzyme? Carbonic anhydrase. And when bicarbonate gets into the lungs, carbonic anhydrase converts it back into CO2, and then you breathe it out of your body. That's how that works. Okay. All right, a couple other little things. Control of respiration. Your respiration is controlled by the respiratory center in your brain. And the respiratory center, you have to know a little bit about what part of the brain it is. Let's see if I can find it. Ah, here it is. Okay. Is the medulla oblongata and the pons. Where the heck are those things at? They're in the brainstem. All right, so here's the brain that's at the base of the brain. So here's the medulla. All right, here's the pons over here. This is the part of the brain that helps regulate ventilation. And if we really zoom into that area, here it is. Here's the pons, and here's the medulla. All right, here's the cerebellum. Even though it's backwards, it doesn't matter. That's where it is. All right, so how does the medulla and the pons tell you to breathe? Well, there are nerves that go from the medulla. Oh, I don't have it on this picture, but there are nerves that go to the diaphragm. So when there's electrical information on these phrenic nerves, it tells the diaphragm to do what? to contract, not to relax, but to contract. All right, and then the diaphragm does what? It flattens out, and you inhale. Okay, so that phrenic nerve is all important, because without a phrenic nerve, you can't breathe. The phrenic nerve originates from a number of cervical vertebrae. Where do you have cervical vertebrae? Yeah, it's in your vertebral column, your spine, but what part of your spine? Cervical is your neck, way up over here. So the nerve has got to come from your neck all the way down to the diaphragm. And fortunately, it's a long way, so the phrenic nerve can be damaged, all right? But it's kind of fortunate because the phrenic nerve comes from three places in your spinal cord. It comes from region C3, C4, and C5. So if there is damage to C3, there's still nerve impulses that can go down to the diaphragm from what? C4 and C5. Or if you break at C4, you can still get nerve impulses down to the diaphragm from C5. So there's a nerve plexus right there, and maybe we talked about nerve plexuses, and it just allows nerve impulses to take alternate routes to get to a vital organ so that you don't die. So that's the beauty of a nerve plexus. So there's a little saying that you can always remember what the origin of the phrenic nerve is, and the saying is C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive. So the phrenic nerve comes from those three levels in the cervical region. C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive. Okay, so that's the output from the respiratory center. Inputs to the respiratory center contain chemoreceptors. So what kind of receptor is a chemoreceptor? It's a receptor that measures some kind of chemical in your body, right? A chemoreceptor measures a chemical, and some chemicals that these chemoreceptors measure are carbon dioxide, hydrogen ion, because hydrogen ion is how we measure pH, as well as carbon dioxide, as well as some oxygen. So you have chemoreceptors in a couple places that can measure CO2, oxygen, and hydrogen ion concentration, or pH. So there are central receptors. They're located in the medulla nepans. That's where the respiratory center is. And these are very sensitive to small changes in carbon dioxide, small changes in pH. Right? So if there's a buildup of CO2 in your body, what do you think your body should do? You should start breathing to get rid of that CO2. So these chemoreceptors in the medulla and the pons are very sensitive to small changes in CO2. So if we closed all the doors in here and put in CO2, very low levels of CO2, that would stimulate all of our respiratory centers and we would start hyperventilating. Okay? Or if we were to breathe into a paper bag or the balloon repeatedly, that would cause us to hyperventilate. All right? And as CO2 goes up, where's that little diagram? As CO2 increases, what happens to the hydrogen ion concentration? Remember this equation right here, this chemical reaction? As CO2 increases, because of carbonic anhydrase, what also increases? Hydrogen ion concentration increases and the pH drops. You become more acidic as CO2 builds up in your body. So as hydrogen ion concentration increases, that is also a very powerful stimulus for ventilation, for breathing. It's going to give you an urgency to breathe. All right, so increasing CO2 or decreasing pH, because decreasing pH means what? More acidity or less? More. Decreasing pH means more acidity. Don't forget that little trick. So that's going to be a very powerful stimulus for inspiration. So these receptors are in what? They're central, in your brain. You also have some peripheral receptors, right? In the carotid sinus and the aortic arch, where are those at? Here's the heart. Here's the arch of the aorta. Here are where some other chemoreceptors are. This is the carotid sinus. These have chemoreceptors as well. These chemoreceptors are kind of sensitive to oxygen. But notice, look at all these little arrows right here. That means that it's very insensitive. There has to be a huge change in oxygen concentration before these receptors, these peripheral receptors, send information to the brain to increase ventilation. So the most sensitive receptors are CO2 and pH, and the ones that hardly operate at all are only oxygen. So only when you're really hypoxic, only when you're really starving for air, do these receptors stimulate ventilation. All right. The last thing is, so here's the brainstem. The brainstem is really close to the cerebrum. What's going on inside the cerebrum? That's where you're appreciating reality. That's where you're thinking, right? That's where you're interacting with people. So the cerebrum is really kind of the place where you're experiencing reality. So anything you're experiencing is in the cerebrum. That's very close to the brainstem, and there are interconnections. So what's ever happening in your everyday life has an effect on your respiratory rate. So these are in your, the areas in your cerebrum are what we call higher centers. So things, your higher centers can affect your respiratory rate, like your cerebral cortex can control your ventilatory rate. Maybe you're a clarinet player and you got to take a deep breath and hold that breath, and you blow through a wind instrument to play music. That's due to what? The cerebral cortex controlling your respiratory rate, right? Or maybe you, when you were growing up, when you really wanted to scare your parents, maybe you were upset, you could hold your breath until what happened? You would pass out, all right, to freak your parents out. But that's not really such a big deal, because after you passed out, what automatically happens? Your CO2 is way elevated. That stimulates the respiratory center in the medulla and the pons. And then even though you're unconscious, that's going to increase your ventilatory rate. So when you pass out, you're just going to start breathing normally again. Okay. But other things, emotional content in your life will work via the hypothalamus and also change your respiratory rate. So these higher centers certainly can have an effect on your respiratory rate. And then lastly, other things that control respiration are proprioceptors. What the heck are proprioceptors? That was from the senses chapter. These things you have in muscles and joints. And as soon as you start using muscles and joints, these proprioceptors send information to the medulla and pons. And as you use a muscle, you need more oxygen or less oxygen? You need more. So just by moving joints, your body prepares for exercise and it increases the amount of air that you can absorb. So even though you're sitting down right now, if you were to move your hips and your knees, right, flex and extend your hips and your knees, even though you're not really exercising because you're sitting still, guess what's going to happen to you? You're going to have an urgency to breathe, because those proprioceptors are sending impulses to the medulla and the pons. And of course, other receptors can change your ventilatory rate, like touch. Okay, I suppose if you're walking through a doorway and you don't see, and it's a glass door and you don't see it's closed, you hit that glass door, guess what you're going to do? You're going to start hyperventilating. Okay, touch, pain. What happens to your ventilatory rate if somebody pokes you with a pin? You're going to start hyperventilating, right? Huh? Oh, really? Okay, that's interesting. All right. And temperature. Like if I have an ice cube and I put it on your back, what are you going to do? Yeah, you're going to go, you're going to change your respiratory rate. That's what we call the gasp reflex. When you experience something very, very cold, that produces a gasp reflex. And the ocean around here is really, really cold. So if you were to fall in the ocean, guess what's going to happen when you hit the water? You're going to go, but then what happens if your mouth is underwater? Well, yeah, you could drown very easily as a result of that. So a lot of people drown as a result of that gasp reflex if they fall into some place that's really, really cold. It could be a swimming pool, you know, in the middle of wintertime, or the ocean around here. All those things affect your respiratory rate. All right, so that's it for lecture, but how about let's go over some of the end of the chapter questions. And I don't know if I have them. I thought I had them. Yeah, I don't know if those are the right ones though. Who printed them out from the internet? This one right here? You have these right here? No, you don't have those. Well, maybe that one. What structures make up the upper respiratory tract? That's the nose, the nasal cavity, the mouth, and the pharynx, right? So it's mostly the nasal cavity and the pharynx for upper respiratory tract. What structures make up the lower respiratory tract? Where does the lower respiratory tract start? The larynx, right? So the larynx, the trachea, the bronchi, all the small bronchi, bronchioles, and the lungs. Which structures contain cartilage? So the larynx does? Yeah, I think you need that back. I'm going to have to look on somebody else's paper. Okay, so which contain cartilage? Cartilage. You got the larynx, you got the trachea, and you got bronchi. Those contain cartilage. Bronchioles don't have cartilage. They just have muscle, smooth muscle. What's the next question? Where does gas exchange take place in the lung? That's easy. Alveolus, yeah. Alveolus, if you want to say, or alveolus, that's fine. What structure usually prevents the entry of food into the larynx that gets lazy on Friday nights? Usually associated with horsing around. What is that structure called? The trapdoor? It's called the epiglottis. Epiglottis. What compound neutralizes surface tension and allows the alveoli to expand and inflate? Surfactant is the chemical compound. It's like a soap. Okay. Next question, number 5. What are the 4 parts of the respiratory membrane starting inside the alveolus? What lines the alveolus? Really thin layer, allows the alveolus to expand. Surfactant. So that's the first one. Second part is the wall of the alveolus. The third part is the interstitial space. And the fourth part is the wall of the capillary. And then that oxygen that's coming in is inside your body. Number 6. What kind of epithelium is an alveolus made of? Simple squamous. It's got to be thin for diffusion. It's got to be thin. So simple squamous is the best. And then, what is the purpose of the shape of the alveoli? The shape of that alveolus is for increasing surface area for exchange, right? So exchange is the important concept. So how big? What is the surface area of your lungs if we were to add all the alveoli together? Half of a tennis court. Okay. All right, so number 7 is, know where the parietal and visceral pleura is located. What's found between the two membranes? Between the two membranes is serous fluid, or pleural fluid. And the two membranes on the lung itself, touching the lung, is the visceral pleura. On the wall of the thorax is the parietal pleura. And by the way, you can have an infection of the pleural membranes. Anybody know what that's called? That's called pleurisy. Did anybody ever have that in here? Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know if that was. Yeah, it was really miserable. Because as soon as you start to move your lungs, the pleura might feel like you're being stabbed in the chest with a knife. I don't know if you felt that or not. So when you feel that bad, when somebody's stabbing you in the chest, you want to breathe. You don't want to breathe. You don't want to move. But if you don't breathe, how do you feel? Well, you don't feel very good either. So you're in between these two conditions of being stabbed in the chest or feeling like you're going to die because you're not breathing. So it's a pretty miserable condition. Yeah. But it's usually treated with antibiotics, and you get over it fairly quick. And, oh, but if you're in serious pain, what else do you get for serious pain? I don't know if they gave you this, but they probably should have if it was really bad. What do you get for serious pain, uncontrolled pain? You get morphine. Okay, so I don't know if they put you on morphine or not until you got over it, but morphine is good so that, what, you can breathe. It's always good to be able to breathe. What is the name of the instrument used to measure pulmonary volumes? Yeah, the spirometer. Spirometer. Okay, and then, do we have another question? Yeah. Oh, good, a couple more. Know what tidal volume is, inspiratory reserve, expiratory reserve, and know what vital and residual capacities are. We know you could say residual capacity or residual volume, either one of those. But just work that little diagram that you have to go over those. That's pretty easy. You have a nice internet resource for that. How is oxygen transported in the blood? It combines to something. What does it combine to? Hemoglobin. Where is hemoglobin? In red blood cells. How is carbon dioxide carried in the blood? As bicarbonate. Yeah, as bicarbonate ion. What is the chemical symbol for bicarbonate? HCO3, and then there's a little minus. It's an ion. What kind of ion is that? It's an anion, yeah, monovalent anion. What enzyme interconverts carbon dioxide and bicarbonate? Carbonic anhydrase, is it? Where's the respiratory center located? You'd say the medulla and the pons. I suppose you could say brainstem, but medulla and pons would even be better. Medulla oblongata and the pons and the brainstem. What nerve innervates the diaphragm, and is it good to have one like that? That would be the phrenic nerve. And of course, you need to have a nice, healthy phrenic nerve or you can't breathe. All right, so phrenic nerve, yeah, it comes from C3 through C3, C4, and C5. Oh, where do the spinal roots of the phrenic nerve originate? C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive. All right, so from cervical region 3, cervical region 4, and 5. Number 12, where are the chemoreceptors for CO2 and pH located? Those are the central receptors in the respiratory center, in the medulla and the pons. Very sensitive to small changes in CO2 are going to produce large changes in how you want to breathe. Where are the chemoreceptors for oxygen located? Those are what we call the peripheral receptors in the arch of the aorta and the carotid sinus, which is up in your neck, arch of the aorta and carotid sinus. What chemicals are the most powerful stimulus for ventilation? What chemicals stimulate your respiratory rate the most? CO2 is one, and oxygen is not. That's surprising. That always surprises me. Oxygen is not very important for controlling your respiration. It's CO2, and it's pH, which is what? Hydrogen ion concentration, acidity. So CO2 and acidity control your respiration, but oxygen, only when you're almost dead, does oxygen play a role. So that's kind of strange, I think. And then the last question is, what other factors can influence the rate and depth of ventilation? Higher centers in the brain, right? Voluntary control, emotional states, pain, temperature. Other kinds of stimuli can control your ventilatory rate. Maybe, you know, if you're an athlete, maybe just thinking about exercise will increase your respiratory rate. Okay. Now, did you want to go over some questions at the end of the last chapter?
Yeah. 16, 17, 18, and 19.
All right, so let's look at those. Number 16 from the lymphatic chapter. What are the two types of lymphocytes which produce specific resistance? The two types are B lymphocytes and T lymphocytes, the B and T. The B and T. Which type produces antibody-mediated immunity? Antibody. B. Remember, there's a B in antibody, so the B lymphocyte. Which type produces cell-mediated T? And why is it the T lymphocyte? Because they're contact killer. It's a contact killer. But the real reason is because the T cells mature in the thymus gland, so that's why we call it a T cell. But good thing there's a lot of T's in contact killing. All right, so it's a T cell. Number 17, what kind of cell produces long-lasting immunity? Long-lasting immunity. Let's see if I can remember. It's called a memory cell, right? is going to be a memory cell, like memory B cell for producing antibodies, memory T cell for producing contact killers. How long? Let's go to number 19. That's important. Name the cell that produces antibodies. That can be a little tricky. Okay, so it's due to antibody-mediated immunity, which is a B cell line, but it's not the B cell. A B cell, when it's stimulated, when it's activated by an antigen, turns into a plasma cell and a memory cell. Memory cell gives you long-lasting immunity, and the plasma cell is the one that actually makes the antibodies. So the answer to number 19 is a plasma cell, but the plasma cell comes from the B lymphocyte. All right, so don't just say B lymphocyte. Know that it comes from the plasma cell. All right, let's go back to 18. How long does a primary response take to effectively respond?
14 days.
Weeks, right? Maybe 2 weeks. All right, so you have some jeopardy there. How long does the secondary response take to effectively respond?
Hours.
It's fast, right? Hours. Maybe a week, maybe a couple days, but it's fast. Secondary response, because of those memory cells, right, they can kick in and start fighting that infection right away. Okay, so I guess that's it, unless somebody's got some questions. No questions? All right, so I'll see you Thursday. So don't forget the chapters that are on the test. What are they? 12, 13, 14, and 16. 12, 13, 14, 16. Your grades are down over here.